was done. I was like broken. So I even still tried to compete. And
with the broken back?
Yeah, it was such a low point. I just felt like all the frustration, all the stress, all the sadness that year was just all like that moment of me just lying down on the floor and the ambulance having to come. I could be given everything I needed to succeed, but because of my own like anxieties and fear, I couldn't move forward. When I started BYP Now, I was 24 years old. I started in my bedroom. I was like, oh, this is an idea I have to change the narrative. And the narrative of the Black community is so negative. Like, it's knife crime, it's gun crime, it's low attainment, it's not getting into top jobs, we're not CEOs, which is always negative.
You've grown massively. You've got 150,000 members. What do you think has allowed you to build it to this stage? And what will help you build it to the next stage? Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for making the time, especially given you had a bit of a podcast hiatus.
Yes, I have.
I get everyone to do a bit of an intro of themselves. Okay. So can you tell people what they should know about the legendary Kike Onwuendi Okoro?
I don't know about legendary, but I guess I'm a mum. I'm a mum to a two-year-old darling girl. I love so much. My wife, love my husband, shout out my husband. I'm a founder, so I run a company called BYP Network, and we're all about advancing the careers of Black professionals around the world and changing the Black narrative. I'm also the vice chair of the Black Business Association, the London Chamber of Commerce and Industry Black Business Association, and I sit on the board of Getting On Board as well. I guess I am a sister to all the brothers. I'm a daughter. My mum is not in the world anymore, but I'm still her daughter. And I'm a friend. I have friends and we love spa days. Yeah.
So I'd love to start in the world of sport.
Okay.
You represented GB for javelin for years, but specifically I love to speak about when you broke your back during your undergrad and you had to take some time out and obviously recover. And then when you came back, you threw your PB a year after breaking your back.
Yeah.
How?
Oh God, that was like the hardest period of my life at the time. So I was in my second year of university at the time of a 3-year course. So I would have been about 20. And at that time, it's so interesting, I was living on campus. And normally, I think those who went to university, you kind of first years live on campus and then you go off and live with other people. But I lived on campus because actually I wasn't meant to stay at the University of Nottingham. I'd got an opportunity to study at Harvard, but I got it quite late in the game. And so essentially what happened was they wanted me to come out and be in their prep school for a year and then essentially do the exams and then go into Harvard. And then I would have actually been either graduated my university or like my final year. So it didn't make any sense. It's like, well, I might as well finish my university. So it happened quite late, essentially, the whole situation. And I'd wish I knew about it earlier. And that's, I always talk about access to information. If you don't have information, there's so many things you lose out on. So I could have got the opportunity and gone if I knew about it, like when I was 16, for example. But I got the opportunity at 18. It was too late. I was already going to university. So I say all that to say that I was already battling that. I was like, oh God, I missed out on going to this university. But I remember my uncle said, you know, you'll be who you're supposed to be with or without Harvard. So shout out to my uncle for that. And so I was kind of processing that. And then I was stuck on campus. And definitely the word was stuck because it wasn't for second years. It was for first years. Also where I was staying was not diverse at all. So I was literally the only Black student in that whole hall. I was sick every other week, pretty much for the whole year, because you're in a halls, just sick people all around. So I was pretty much sick the whole year. Just this is about the injury. So I was already battling kind of all of that. And then the university course was, I did economics. And second year is when it actually counts towards your grades. And my grades were in the bin. I was like on like 51, which is like a 2-2, like a low 2-2. So that first year January exams, my results had come and it was just so bad. So I was already kind of on this kind of like, oh my God, I'm even failing university now and I'm staying on campus, I'm going through regret. And then also my coaching situation wasn't great. So first year university, it was amazing. I had the best time at first year university. I also had, I was part of the GB junior coaching setup in Loughborough. So I used to travel to Loughborough like every week, essentially to train with the GB coach and the team, the squad. It was just amazing. But that was 2012 Olympics. So as soon as Olympics was done, his contract was done and all that investment was done. So when it's the second year with no coach, essentially, no team, no setup. And so I was having to kind of my initial coach from London told me to go to this other coach that's kind of in Birmingham at the moment. So from Nottingham, I drive to Birmingham, which is like an hour. So I'd be driving to Birmingham on the weekends to kind of coach with this newest coach and figuring it out. It was just a mess. Everything was a mess, basically. And I remember we were just doing a training session and something just went in my back. Like, I just felt this weird feeling. Like, it was so stiff. Like, it felt like being winded is the best way I can describe it. And I was just in so much pain. I was like, okay, yeah, I think I'm done. Like, let's stop. But I didn't know what was kind of going on. And it stayed. It just wouldn't go away. So I was just couldn't walk properly, essentially. I was just in so much pain. I always remember, like, just having to hold my back as I'm walking just so I can walk. I don't know. I was living in this fantasy, like, oh, I'm not really injured. I was just making it up. Like, I have that issue sometimes where I'm, like, ignoring my own truth. Like, I'm not injured, just making it up. So I even still tried to compete. So I competed at the British University Championships. And
with a broken back?
Yeah, with a broken back, yeah. And bear in mind, I hadn't actually done anything as well. Like, I haven't done any kind of solutions. I just like had a bad back that was holding, that's in pain. So it happened in February. So competition now in May. So this is like 3 months, haven't done anything. Just I'm in pain and I'm holding my back and not even taking medicine and stuff like that. I went to compete at the British University Championships. And I had sometimes you can have this wrap around your back. So I put the wrap around my back, just like, all right, cool. That can help hold me in and throw. I did one throw, like, whatever. It got me a bronze, which wasn't good. I'm never happy. So that wasn't even good enough. But I did one throw and I was done. I was like broken. Like, my mum and her partner at the time had to carry me off the runway. They had to carry me off the runway. I could hardly walk. I remember we went to go get food. Because again, I'm still downplaying it, but I'm like in pain. I was like, oh, let me just go to the bathroom. I stepped out and fell to the floor. Like, I couldn't get up. But again, I was still kind of like, oh no, I'm sure I'm fine. I'm sure it's nothing. Like, even to my, like, literally, I'm like, no, oh no, whatever. So they were like, okay, come back with us to London. Like, so we can like look after, just come back with us. I was like, no, it's fine. Like, I'll stay at the hotel and go back with the team tomorrow. Like, just, no, honestly, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. So they dropped me back at the hotel because I made it out like I'm fine. I had to call the ambulance. I could not move. Like, I could not move at all. It was so bad. I think I had gone to try to take a shower and I just couldn't, like, I couldn't move. It was just, I always remember, it was such a low point. I just felt like all the, like, frustration, all the stress, all the sadness, like, yeah, it was just all, like, that moment of me just lying down on the floor with a bad back and the ambulance having to come. So, yeah, long story short, so after that situation, I got given, like, strong medicines, like codeine, cocodamol, tramadol,
yeah.
Crazy, like, strong drugs like that. I had to basically, I couldn't continue the rest of my year, my exams. I couldn't do my exams. I had to stay in Nottingham over summer because I had to still sit those exams. It just had to be later on. Otherwise, I have to take another year, which I didn't want to do. And then as part of all of that, taking those drugs, I was just, yeah, the pain went, but I was a mess. So I realized from there I couldn't take such strong drugs. So yeah, that's long story short.
Jesus Christ. That is a journey.
It's terrible.
What was it about your mindset that made you just deny the fact that your body was screaming at you?
I've always been like that, which is so bad. And this is a problem, as you know, with women, especially Black women, like, medical don't even take us seriously. They think, oh, we're exaggerating. So I think that is part of it, kind of gets a bit ingrained. So to me, it's like, oh, no, it's nothing. No, I'm sure it's fine. Like, I always kind of I think to say there's something wrong is extreme, even though there is something wrong. So it took me a long time to admit that I am literally injured, like really badly. And obviously made it worse with actually competing when I shouldn't have. I don't know what was the catalyst for that, for me being that way. But yeah, I was someone who just kind of liked to minimize saying, no, it's not like, maybe just don't know, don't bother, it's fine. So yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, that does sound like it could have some, it could have been something worse.
It could have been worse. I could have really, really done even more damage. And it was an L5 pars tear defect. It was just something, like, I always remember that wording, but it was like something to do with my spine. Like I had literally fractured my spine. And so I had to sit out and do no training and nothing. And that was hard mentally. Because in my mind, I'm like, I need to train, or I need to, you know, if I'm not training. And just sitting out that one, just that one season was so hard. It's like, I need to be competing. This is terrible. I was so impatient as well. I think that's part of it, especially with injuries. You have to be patient. But I never was. And so, yeah, I just, it was very, very hard mentally. That whole year was so tough. And then what happened was September start now, going back to university. Well, it basically wasn't university the whole year. At this point, my grade had improved. So I was on like 54. You know, that extra creeping three up makes a huge difference, okay? So it had just like, yeah, just about improved. And I think I just had a mindset of like, no, I have to turn things around. Like I can't, you know, not get the grade. Like my sporting career feels like it's done. And it was my identity as well at the time. I was very academic. I was very athletic. Like that was my identity. So to lose both at the same time was just so challenging. But I remember my faith, like I'm a Christian, it is high, but it was so strong. Like I was listening to gospel music all the time. Like I never forget walking from campus to like my halls. It's this long walk in the back fields or whatever. And I was just always listening to like this gospel song and holding my back as I'm walking the journey and it's cold. That's always my memory of like university. Sorry to my university, but that's always my memory. But yeah, basically in the end, I was so disciplined. I was so dedicated. I trained like 5 days a week. I trained on my own because I didn't really have a coach, like I said. I would go to the gym. I'd set my own training schedule. Luckily, Nottingham, they were kind. They gave me like a physio. So I was like a sports bursar as part of it. So I had a bit of their support as well. And I was just like I can turn this around. I just had this faith. And yeah, in the end, I managed to throw a personal best, which essentially got me my scholarship to the University of Florida. So without that personal best, I wouldn't have got to University of Florida. And I think what was even more crazy is if I didn't have that year off because of my injury, I wouldn't have got my 2 years competing in NCAA. So that year of injury meant that I could actually compete at NCAA. So if I didn't get that, I couldn't go to University of Florida. So everything happens for a reason.
You can only connect the dots looking back.
Like, literally. So that injury actually gave me that big opportunity.
I just realised I blasphemed earlier, so I apologise.
Oh, did you? Oh,
yeah. Oh, okay. I'm glad you didn't listen. So I'll be conscious more about not doing
how
that.
How dare you?
It also sounds really lonely.
Yeah.
You're on campus when all of the other second years are going into other housing. You then have to just be in halls around a bunch of other first years while you're recovering. Mm. Sounds like a really lonely experience.
Yeah, no, it was. It was really, that's what I mean. It was just so dark that second year of university. It was just such a hard time in general. I think the only thing was like, you know, I still had friends, obviously. I'd meet them on campus or we'd go out sometimes. I didn't go out much, obviously, especially with my back. My back was second from February, right? So I guess it's September to January. But from that February onwards, definitely did not go out, did not go anywhere, did not barely saw anyone. And then I was just trying to figure out how I'm going to get my grades up as well. So it definitely, that's what I mean. That, like, I think of it as a very lonely experience, walking that long journey, that hill. And that, like, if anyone went to Nottingham, they'll know what I'm talking about. They have this area that is like just all green grass to get you from halls to the main kind of campus area. So that's always the vision I have, or the memory I have. It's just like that, just dull, the weather's bad, walking on alone, holding my back and just feeling so depressed. I know the word is depressed, but I guess it was probably depressed, but I just didn't know. I was just so down. Yeah, it's tough.
How did your mentality change during that period?
When I was in it, when I was thick in it, like I said, my faith, I just had to lean, like I had nothing else. Like you literally have to just lean on faith of like, I will get through this. Like, I just have to like keep going. I will get through this. I think me not having to do my exams, that period helped a bit. So my exams had to be August instead of May. Yeah, I think it's May time. So that did help a bit, just having that kind of ability to rest a bit more. But I couldn't do my exams because of the drugs. So I was so drowsy. It just was impossible. But I think I just, I binge watched Game of Thrones in that period. That was pretty awesome. So I became a fan. I watched like 7 seasons or however many seasons was out at the time. So I always remember that, like, I just, nothing else I could do. I just could just watch TV. So yeah. I just binged a lot of TV at that time. And I think it was post all of that, right? I think that was tough, but I think it showed me I can get through anything. That's what that period always reminds me of. Like, I can get through anything. Like, that was just so difficult as a 20-year-old, or, you know, living on campus, living away from family, with their identity in a whole crisis. So to have got past that, I think that's what it did to me. Let me know, like, I could probably, like, overcome most things. But it's tough. I don't want to be tested like that again.
But then you went to Florida and you got this full scholarship. Yes. And then
I got tested again.
You got tested again. And that felt like it was, like, even more intense, because they invested so much more into you. They gave you these, like, insane facilities. They cooked you this mental food. And you had, like, medical every morning, really focused on creating the best possible athletes, right?
Yeah.
And you were there on this full scholarship where a bunch of other athletes kind of, like, dropped into javelin.
Sports in general, yeah.
Or just sports in general. And you were, like, this hallmark, Brit who'd come over to be the shining light of like the team, right? And then but then you didn't perform.
No, I did not. God, when you put it like that, exactly that. I think it was, so for me, so I got this opportunity and, like, this is incredible. Oh my God, so exciting. And again, I remember how it happened, because I had said, okay, after university, I'm just gonna take a year out and focus on my sport and not focus too much on, like, a career or getting a job. I had done loads of investment banking internships and I was like, it's not for me. It's not diverse enough. Like, I felt that's not my industry. So I was like, I'll take a year out. And then a coach from, I think it was Iowa University or something, reached out saying that, oh, love to have a chat about me potentially coming doing a master's there and competing for them. And I was like, wait, oh, I can still, there's still a chance for me to go to America. I thought that the ship has sailed, the whole Harvard thing and undergrad. Like, I genuinely just thought, like, I didn't even think about America because I thought that had been done. Well, actually, my grandma, to be fair, was like, oh, if you want to do, like, I can't remember how America came off, maybe before. She's like, I'll pay for you to go to America and we to do a degree or to do your master's out there. I was like, oh my God, that's so amazing. She's like, yeah, we'll both live out there together and we'll in a house. And I said, no, I'm not going out with my grandma. Like, what the
hell? This is your mum's mum.
My mum's mum, but sadly she died that summer. Yeah, I know. Wow. So she sadly died that summer. She was 79. She would have been 80 in September. But what was crazy, obviously she died that summer, but then I got this scholarship to America. So it just felt like her legacy. Again, I'm that kind of person. Like, I really do connect the dots. I really do see these things in, like, just like how great they are, like, in terms of opportunities. So there was that situation in Iowa. I was like, I don't really want to go to Iowa. That doesn't look like somewhere I want to go. So I think I just did some research on universities that are good for javelin. And I sent, like, an email out to 3 of them just to be like, hi, this is a bit about me. You know, this is what I've done. Just wasn't expecting anything. I thought, might as well try. And then I think 2 months later, I got an email from the University of Florida, from the coach at the time. She's like, hi, you know, just seen your email, just something like that. Like, I'd love to give you a full scholarship to come out here starting in January. So this is November. Starting in January, everything covered.
Sorry, you sent one email and this was their reply.
Yeah. Wow. But I was a great athlete, right? Like, in terms of, like, my distance. So it was just under 55 meters. So that's not that far from, like,
Olympic record.
Olympic standard. At the time, it was like 60 meters, right? So I'm not that far away. I was a national champion at the time in javelin. I won loads of national championships. I had represented Great Britain at that point. So in terms of, like, accolade, like, I was a great athlete. So that was like you are a great athlete. Here, there is an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I was thinking maybe it'll be next year, September or something. But for them to be like, we have the opportunity for you to start in January, and their courses lined up. So I chose a master's in management, had a January start date because they start in both September and January. It just all worked out. So it was the most, like, incredible email to have received. I thought it was a joke. I remember just how happy I was, excited about it. Everything moved so fast. Like, luckily, I'd already done the GRE exam, because in my mindset of like, oh, maybe if I go, whenever that happens, let me just get, do that exam. So I was ready for January because I had already been pre-planning ahead. It just all worked out. It was just insane. It was just so perfectly timed. So you can imagine, I'm like excited. I'm like, this is incredible. I can't remember how much the scholarship was worth, but I think over the 2 years, it must have been about 100K or something like that. Like, I'm sure it was something like that in terms of the course, my master's degree, my accommodation, my food, my clothing, the books, just even the books, the medical, everything. So in all, it was a hefty investment, right? And most athletes go for 4 years. They go undergrad and it's for 4 year degree, right? Course. I was only going for like a year and a half. So it was a shorter period of time. And people always say you do need that 4 years there because it's a new environment. It's a new coaching setup, different weather. Like, it was Florida. I was in the UK. So completely different weather. So they say it tends to take you a year and a half to adjust to a new training. So I didn't have that time. That's one thing I can look back at. It's like, I only had a year and a half.
And then also, isn't it right that people say you should have 2 years with a coach to really
exactly.
settle
That's
into
my point.
Their...
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't, my time there was a year and a half. So technically I didn't, you know, you don't think that. I'm not thinking like, oh, I need that. I'll be fine. I'll get there. I'll smash it. But yeah, literally, I just regressed. I could not throw the javelin. I always say it's like I lost my superpower. It's like, you know, being Clark Kent and like you just stay Clark Kent because you can't become Superman again. Like, I just couldn't throw. I did not know how to anymore. It's like my whole body changed. Like, I felt just anxiety. I was consumed. I hold the javelin and I'm like shaking. I had never experienced that before in my whole entire life. And I could not shake it. I think that was the crazy part. Like, I could not get rid of it. For the whole year and a half, I could not get rid of it. And I always say, as soon as like it was all done and I went back home to the UK, I was myself again. It went. Like, literally, like, I landed, got off the plane, I was myself. So I just always found that weird, the fact that like your body reacts to changes that you don't know how to control. So that way it was difficult. And it was only on reflection I took in just how much of a great experience I had, like in terms of where I stayed. I'm still friends with like my roommates. One was a tennis player, one was a golfer. The food, like you said, I had lobsters and sushi and steak. Like, that was the food they gave us, unlimited food. Florida, hot weather. I was in Miami, LA, got to travel so much. So it was great, but I think because, again, like, as you can see, I'm quite hard on myself, or I don't, like, I did not want to believe I'm not good anymore at my sport. I'm like, oh, I can figure this out. I can. So I think that also added to it. Like, I'm trying to solve, like, what is going on, which probably added to, like, why I couldn't move forward the way I wanted to. So I ended, I think, at the time, fifth all-time javelin thrower at the University of Florida. But I threw 4 meters less than what I came in with, when in my mind, I thought I was going there to throw 60 meters. Like, I thought I was going to, you know, be a professional athlete because I've got the whole setup. I've got everything I need. Whereas previously I trained on my own, like, no help on my, it was lonely. So that was so interesting to me that I could be given everything I needed to succeed. But because of my own like anxieties and fear, I couldn't move forward. And that's why now I don't face imposter syndrome, because that's essentially what it was, imposter syndrome. Because that's what it does to you. Who wants that done to you? It doesn't make any sense.
It seems like this crazy identity crisis that you go there to be this athlete and suddenly you've regressed back 4 meters from what you were throwing in the UK when you didn't have all of these facilities. What did you learn about dealing with an identity crisis? Because whatever you were trying out in Florida obviously didn't work, and then you got back to the UK, you got off the plane, and suddenly you're like, oh, I'm myself again. Mm. If you were faced with that same identity crisis now, how would you approach it differently?
Again, I don't know how I'd approach it differently, because one thing I learned, it just is your body, honestly. Maybe I would have got hypnosis or something like that. I don't know. I always thought, but there's nothing I felt like I could have done back then. I felt like I tried my hardest. Like, I couldn't shake my body. I couldn't shake what was going on. But I think what it did teach me, though, is that I can overcome anything. And it was different from my broken back, because this was also like reputation wise as well, right? Like, eyes are on me. That's how it felt. I think part of it is I felt like, oh, a lot of people are watching in the UK, a lot of people watching in America, whatever, what am I going to do? I've got all this pressure. But even when I wasn't performing, I remember I still continued to compete that season. Like, I didn't stop when my American season, I still came home, still competed, even though I was not competing well. So I still was throwing crap, but I still showed up. I carried on going to the competitions. I got beat by people that who should never have beaten me. And I remember thinking that, like, wow, I'm still showing up. And that's what I took from it. Like, it's so important to keep showing up, regardless of how bad the results are looking or like what you're telling, like, just show up. And even in Florida, I continue to show up to the training, even though obviously I can't not, but I did continue to show up. And there were times where I was like, I quit. I called my mom, I quit. I'm leaving. I can't do this. I'll have to show up the next day and go to training. And like, even though I'm embarrassed AF because, you know, my performance was terrible and I can see, like, I'm embarrassed, but I still showed up. And I think that was my learning, like, just show up.
Yeah. Huge respect. That is mad.
It's embarrassing.
So it felt like all the pressure was on then. Does it not feel like you're still under pressure now? You're doing so many things. You're running this incredible business. Yeah, how does it feel now?
No, it doesn't. That's the straight. It doesn't feel like pressure at all. Like, I think that situation did change me. Not the first one was different because, again, broke my back and then I, you know, just worked harder and then I overcame. Then in America, it was like, oh my God, this pressure has meant that I did not succeed or I did not do what I needed to do. So in business now, I don't feel the pressure. Like, no matter what we've done, even the crowdfunding, I just don't feel the pressure because I'm like, it's just so pointless because that will make you fail. And no matter what will be, will be. And I chose to do this business to make a difference. So it's my choice. I chose this. It's a bit different. I know people invest and stuff like that, but it's different from the sporting because it was like, yes, I chose to do sports and it was fun and games, but then I got this actual investment with all eyes on me and facility thrown at me. It was very intense like that. But I think business, it's like it's day to day, right? You do the day to day, you take the wins in, you have your conversations, you meet who you need to meet. And it's tough, of course, but I don't in any way, shape or form feel the way I felt when I was in Florida.
I'd love to go deeper into this comparison between sport and business. Mm. I have this idea that as CEOs need to be athletes of the mind. You still have to have the same level of discipline. You still have to have the same level of consistency. But can you speak to the similarities and the differences between the sporting world and the business world?
Yeah, no, you're right, though. I think someone's saying, oh, you're lucky for you, you're a CEO, so you can shut whenever you want or whatever. Someone's like, no. That's not true. I have my set hours and my set time. Like, I'm disciplined of, all right, I start work at this time, end at this time. And I feel strange if I don't feel productive. So I'm like, oh, I just wasted half an hour doing nothing. Oh my God, I got to make it up. That's how I still feel mentally. It's not that I'm like, oh, I can do what I want and walk around and not do anything. That's just not the case. I think I always said that it felt easy going into entrepreneurship. It didn't feel like a learning curve. It felt like, oh, I'm just doing something I enjoy doing and I'm trying to make a difference and I can do it. I've always been someone who's good at doing many things well, like from a young age. Like, I always think about my GCSEs was like every subject. It was literally every random subject.
You got eight A stars and three A's.
Yeah.
At the local state school.
At local state school, exactly. And it was random subjects. Literally, I had like, you could throw in RE, you could throw in drama, you could throw in science, you could throw in like whatever. It was all random, but I still got good grades in all of them. And that, I think that's always been me. I'm someone who can do like loads of stuff very well. And that's been transferred again from sports because sports, you have to have that discipline. You have to show up. It's hard work. And so in business, it's the same thing.
But hold on, those feel like two different things. One feels like talent and the other feels like mindset. You can have talent, but not be hardworking and not be disciplined. And you can not have talent, but you can be disciplined and hardworking. But you sound like you have the magical combination of both.
Yeah, that's a good point. You definitely have to. So that's what I mean. Like entrepreneurship, I'd say the word talent, right? Because it felt so natural. That's the first bit. I just did it naturally. When I first thought about doing the business, I just threw an event. I had never done an event before, but I was just like, oh, okay, cool. Find the venue, invite people, make a flyer, put it out on socials, make sure there's drinks, make sure there's games. That was just how, I've never done it before. I've got no degree in events management. Just did it and everyone had a great time. It sold out in like 3 days. It was just incredible. It was like a first launch. There was no rule book. I wasn't reading any like entrepreneurship books. And I always felt like that was straight from like my background because it was like, just get on with it. Like so much having to train on my own. I had to figure it out. I had to watch my videos. I had to figure out what do I need to do next. No one was watching me. Like, I just had to get on with it. That's when I wasn't in Florida, obviously. So I think entrepreneurship, it was just this natural flow of like, okay, no one's what, just get on with it and let's see what happens. And then the hard work that is part of it, like the resilience, the grafting, that is like definitely from sports, because entrepreneurship is so hard. Like running a business, starting a business, scaling a business, it's hard. And I know a lot of us entrepreneurs don't talk about it enough. We just show the glitz and glamour, but it's difficult.
There's also this, in sport specifically, this achievement fallacy. Mm. Can you talk about what that is?
Achievement fallacy is pretty much where you're just always trying to get the next. So imagine an athlete, you know, you make it, you're national champion, well done. But actually you want to be an international champion now. You want to be the best in your age group, you know, in Europe and then the world. Then you want to be the Olympic champion, but that's not enough. You need to be the Olympic record holder, the world record holder. You know, it's like this, like there's always another level, right? And basically you're never ever satisfied. So if you are now the Olympic champion, like those who won the Olympics recently, they might not be satisfied unless they have the Olympic record or the world record. Or they have to think about how they're going to defend the Olympic championships the next time. So it's like this continuous, like, you know, chase. And that's the same also in kind of in business or in life. It's like, there's always something else. There's always something else. You can't sit on what you've achieved. But the problem there is that we don't celebrate enough. Like, I don't celebrate enough. So if you get your medal, celebrate that medal and then focus on the next. So that's something I've been trying to practice.
It's this feeling of like never enough.
Never enough. Yeah. It's never enough. Yeah.
So what feels like enough now?
I have been in a state of gratitude a lot lately. I definitely say, so my mum passed away nearly 3 years ago in December. And I definitely say post her passing away, that's when I've been more in my gratitude stage. And it's mainly because she used to say to me, like, you know, what you don't understand is when you don't celebrate, you don't allow others to celebrate you too. And it's a problem. But I never really understood it. I'm like, well, why should they celebrate me if I'm not happy? I don't understand. But imagine as a parent, like you're so proud of your child, like, oh my God, my child just did this. You know, but your child is looking all sad face because she didn't throw a personal best or because whatever reason, like always a stupid reason. And that was me. Like I would say that was me, which isn't great. I'm putting out my character flaw. So that was always my mum's feedback. Like, how can we celebrate you if you can't celebrate yourself? Like, and also how do your peers feel? If others who maybe not achieving that and you're busy upset with what you've done, how are they meant to feel? And only really took it in once you passed away. Like, oh, okay, maybe I should just start celebrating and taking things in. So I now have a lot more of a gratitude mindset and just always kind of, I'm just happy, I'm grateful, honestly. Like, I've got such a beautiful, funny, intelligent daughter. You know, I'm loved as a wife, as a sister. And also my mum was just so amazing. Like, I had an amazing mum. And I realised not everyone has or had a mum like that. So that I don't take for granted. Like, she was a really special woman. So that as well, I'm like, wow, I don't think I realised what I had. I did realise what I had, but even now.
Did anything else change in your mind after she passed away? Anything else become clearer to you?
I think it's more just life in general, right? Like things, I think I always used to think that I would know when my mum will die. Like, I think that, I don't know about you or anyone else, like, in my mind, I'm like, I will know when my mum will die. Why not? Like, I would know, I'll feel it in my heart, like, my mum's about to die or something. But it came as such a shock and, like, so random. And I, like, the night before, because I was pregnant at the time, so the night before, I was thinking I was really bloated and I had an early night even. So I even was fast asleep to wake up that she's dead. So I think, for me, it was that realisation that, like, this is real life. Like, you can have situations like that you can't predict. And I think it is that kind of, again, you have to keep overcoming in this life. And I just think that she was just so great as a human. So for me to just continue her legacy. And I always say, like, any opportunity to talk about her, maybe one day I'll write a book about her. In fact, I will write a book about her.
Heard it here first.
Yes, exactly. Drop the news. So I think that was mainly it. I think it was just, yeah, it's just mainly always thinking about her as a person and things that she would do or she would say or just her mindset. So, yeah.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
Going back to your childhood, you had two older brothers.
Yes.
And also, like me, raised in a single parent household. Yes. How do you think that crafted you?
So with me, because I never grew up with my dad. He went back to Nigeria when I was like 10 weeks old or something like that, like literally a baby. So I never, ever grew up with a dad. And so I feel like I did not know that I was meant to have a dad. I don't know if that makes sense. So I didn't, it's not like a situation I had one and then he left and I felt it. So my norm was not having one. And then I think, I don't know what age I started realizing, oh, people have dads or something like that. And it was so weird. I always thought, oh, what do I tell people? Like, I remember always saying, oh, what do I tell people if they ask me? It would be a lot easier if he wasn't alive, because I could say, oh, my dad is not alive. That's why I don't have one. So I remember going through that very weird, I know that sounds a bit morbid, but that I went through that weird period as a child. But I know people who have like abandonment or, you know, I don't feel like I really had that. I think maybe what mine became was more of a guard. I think I got more guarded, but not in a negative way with relationships or anything like that, but just in terms of like the beginning of like, oh, okay, things can happen, put the guard up. But otherwise, I had a great childhood. Like, my mom did really, really great. She owned her own home. This is an immigrant from Nigeria. She owned her own home. We never lacked. We had everything that we wanted and needed. So, yeah, I don't know. For me, it's, yeah, I find it strange. I just didn't grow up with one, so I didn't need one.
But you were super independent as a young girl as well, as the youngest of three. You have two older brothers as well, and so it feels like this can-do attitude and this just like go and sort it out, fix your problems. It sounds like it came from then. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Probably. You know, you just never know. I think, that's always been my personality. I've just always been someone who just gets on with things. I think even now, like post-mom, I just get on with it. And I think that's what I mean by my guard. You just get on with it. Like, what can you do? Like, nothing, just get on with it. From young, like, I was always very mature from a young age, maybe because I had two older brothers. Family give you money, like, when they see you and stuff. I always saved my money. Then I remember I'd loan it out to my brothers with interest. I'm, like, 7 years old.
Oh, my days.
Like, literally, like, I remember once, I swear I had, like, £300 or something like that. Like, literally, you get family just randomly give you money when they come. Like, here's £10, or that's just normal in, like, our culture. And I used to just save it, you know, not spend it. And my brothers will always spend their money. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll give you this. But that will be...
I open up the bank and keep
it. Honestly, I remember my grandma said, she said the words, you're such an Ijebu woman, which is like, Ijebu is like somewhere in like Nigeria where like her family grew up or something. So she's like, that's how they are. They're just very like tight with their money or something like that. But it's not that I was tight, I was just very smart with it. And I've just always, like, my mind has always been quite, I always say future focused. I don't know, I've just always believed in myself in a kind of way from a young age. Like, I remember we were watching something, and I don't know what happened on the TV. And I remember turning to my mum, and I was like, oh, mum, we'll never put you in a home. I'll take care of you easily. Like, something like that. And it was real conviction at, like, 5 years old. And, yeah, before she died, she was well taken care of. Like, she didn't have to work for, like, the last 5 years.
There's this future focus, but also the gratitude that you've developed since she's passed, that's very present focused.
Yes.
It's not like, oh, I'm so grateful as to what I'm gonna get. It's, I'm so grateful for what I have right now.
Yes.
So it sounds like this beautiful balance.
That's changed. Yeah, exactly. No, so now I am a lot more present, a lot more like grateful, just literally every morning with my family. Like, I'm just a lot more grateful. And actually, I'm not as future. Like, I'm like, oh, what's the future? Like, what's, I'm like, oh my God, what is the future state? But the old me was like, always, I could never focus on now. It was always the future, always the future. But then, you know, you're living the future that you were dreaming of, but you're not taking it in. So what's the point? So this period of, or this life as focused on gratitude, so much better.
I suppose that also contributes to this focus on the next medal or the next Olympic record or world record or whatever. You're always like thinking about what it could be in the future and not being satisfied with what we have now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, you gave that great point of Adam Peaty saying, like, you know, I focus more on my family, and so I missed out by that 0.1 because of that. And yeah, that's life. Like, when you have to choose your priorities and what that is now. And I think mine has been so much more grounded. I don't know if it's taken away my ambition. I hope not, touch wood, but it definitely, I'm not the same as I was when I used to just be like chase, for sure.
Yeah. How has your ambition evolved?
I think, again, back then, it was like shooting for serious stars. Like, again, as an athlete, remember, I only did about 55 meters or whatever. I'm like, I want to be the world record holder. Nothing's better than that. Like, literally, not even just get to the Olympics, like, world record holder. So it was always very extreme. Whereas I think now it's like, okay, no, we're focused on profitability. we're focused on, okay, this is the plan for the year. Okay, let's get that plan in place. Okay, this is what we want to do with the tech. Let's do that. I think that's more now. And then obviously you still have to have the goals and stuff like that, but it's a lot more loose. Whereas the old me would be like, it has to be an Apple. Be happy, no, it must be Apple. Nothing wrong with that, but I'd say I'm not like that anymore, I'd say. Sorry, investors.
Well, there's like that phrase, isn't it, where we always over expect what we can do in a day, but then under expect what we can do in a year.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like it was like, oh, that your long term was so big.
So drastic, yeah.
So drastic, so extreme that everything short run, unless it was excellent, above and beyond, that self-talk is then like, you're not good enough.
Yes.
Holding yourself to a higher standard, you're beating yourself up.
Yeah, exactly. No, literally, that would be it. It's like, oh, I can do better. This is not good enough. Yeah. And I'd say that was that tended to be my self-talk. Like, oh, this is not good enough. Like my injury, oh, I'm not really injured. I'm faking it. So that's not me anymore. That was a character flaw, and I've changed.
I've got a little present for you. It's just on the topic of family. I had such a beautiful conversation with your uncle Dado, who just had the most beautiful things to say about you. And so do you want to watch what he said?
Oh, good.
Was very able to show an ability to paddle her own canoe, as it were. Because she had these two older brothers, in a way, they made her stronger growing up. And don't forget, my sister was a single parent. You've got three kids fighting for attention and so on and so forth, metaphorically speaking, but most likely actually speaking as well. In a way, made her mentally strong and resilient. And that shone through, you know, in the way she grew up and practically brought herself up. Because while the other two were getting all, you know, grabbing the attention, she was just getting on with things. So, for instance, she didn't need any tutoring for schoolwork. She didn't need any motivation for the athletics that she did. So that resilience kind of was ingrained by nurture. But, you know, she kind of more or less nurtured that herself. You've got to be strong. And she was. She's risen to every challenge. And doesn't see them as a challenge. Maybe that's probably the key thing. Doesn't see them as a challenge. It's just something to do, another opportunity to
do it.
You know, meet something head on. Yeah, I just think of what she does and I'm kind of smiling to myself. You know, she reminds me a lot about my mum.
In what way?
Just that general, well, you know, feeling of just, I am responsible for me, you know, my happiness depends on me kind of mentality, you know. Nobody can make me unhappy, so it's down to me. If I'm feeling bad, it's down to me. If I'm feeling good, it's down to me. That just that general, you can't be miserable when you're around. Somebody who just gets on with stuff, doesn't point fingers. You don't have to be on edge. What you see is what you get.
What were the similarities between your sister and Kike?
Straight talking, not suffering fools, not accepting the kind of I can't word. In a kind of roundabout way, she was very supportive of her mum by not wanting to be demanding of her mum.
Yeah.
Wow. So having a go at doing stuff herself first, and that kind of has been the making of her in a way. I love her to pieces. As I say, I recognize there are similarities with my mum, who I also love and miss very much. But no, we've just always been close. And also, as I say, because my sister had her, she had two other boys already. So I don't know, maybe there was just that natural, oh, you know, while you're busy with those boys, you know, I'm going to hold my niece closer. I just enjoy seeing her crack each new milestone. And I you know, most of my friends and family that know her are also, you know, I would say always jealous of me to have her as my niece, you know. It's just awesome. I don't tell her this often enough, but you know, I am immensely proud and happy to have had to have her as my niece.
Oh, you're sweet, aren't you?
Super nice. Oh, I was just beaming from ear to ear having that conversation with him.
Oh, yeah, no, he's a great uncle. Like, he's been there from the day one. So, yeah, he's the one who said, you'll be who you're supposed to be, with or without Harvard. And really, that's what I always remembered at that time, because it was tough. I'm like, I just missed out on this university. But actually, that statement always it rang true. It's just, I am going to be who I'm supposed to be. Yeah, he's just awesome. Awesome uncle.
Did anything shine through in terms of his description of you?
I love the fact that it's like, one thing I feel like I know myself. I've always like prided myself on, like, I feel like I know myself quite well. Like, you know, not everybody knows themselves, and they can, like, you should always get feedback. But he literally described what I felt of myself. Like, just get on with it. Like, and he's right. I think a lot of it was because I didn't want to burden my mum. So it's like, okay, I want to make sure she's just happy. I don't want to ever be the reason for her unhappiness, and I don't want to ever, you know, be in trouble for any reason. Or so it's not like I tried to be the perfect kid. I was just myself, but myself was making sure that I'm like doing the right things. So like as a young person, that's like, you know, a great example is I was always extra careful. Like, I don't want to die because I wouldn't want my mom to be sad if I died. So again, so morbid, but seriously, like, I wouldn't do risky things like, bungee jumping. Like, I wouldn't do bungee jumping because I'm like, I could die. That's bad for my mom. Not me, my mom. So he's right. Like, a lot of the stuff I did was like just don't want to burden her. Let me be a good kid. Let me just get on with it. And so, like, even my sports, I take myself to the track. I'll just go, catch the bus, come home. Everything, just go on with it. Yeah.
And then how is your relationship with your Tunde?
It's just so interesting. I think it's interesting being a parent, because like, as it's like, knowing how much I love my child, like, makes me realize how much my mum loved me. But it's like, you see this little child that's just growing. So they're not that little baby anymore. They're a toddler. Her personality is coming out. She's just so giddy, so happy. Like, everything is just so exciting. And you just, I'm just like, I just smile all the time. Like, she just makes me smile all the time. And I think it's really wonderful. Like, and me as a parent, I'm just like, you know, want to make sure that she has everything she needs to be who she's supposed to be. Like, that's the key. Like, I would never drive her down any route. But what my desire is, I make sure I give her all the opportunities so she can find her passions, or she can find what she can excel at. So I always think, like, when I was younger and in primary school, like, they were always like, oh, she's quite advanced. We don't know what work to give her. We don't know. There's nothing we can do. So I didn't know anything about, like, 11 plus exams and grammar schools. I didn't have that information. We did not know about it. And I always think, like, obviously, I did well. But it's like, okay, in primary school, I should have known that information. And I think having a child, it's like, I want to make sure I have all the information I need to give them so they can put their best foot forward. So I think that's how I see the relationship now.
I love that framing, because the thing that came to mind was like, another thing that stood out was her excelling. And I was like, oh, but actually the narrative of needing to be excellent feels misaligned, right? But then you said best version of herself, which is different.
Exactly. I don't want to be that parent that's like, you have to be this and that and that. Like, but you can't be lazy, you know? And I would never, if I have to be telling her, oh, you need to get ready and go to your training, or you need to get ready and go to school, that's a problem. Like, why do you not have that self-start yourself? That's how I'd see it. So I don't want to be that push. I'd be like, well, if you don't want to go training, that's fine. I'm not going to push you. That's on you. And I think it's about, how do I make sure she has the skills that she needs? So, like, even now at 2 years old, it's like, she makes a mess. I'm like, yeah, clean it. Yeah, clean mess. Yeah, mess, clean. Have that independence yourself, because it's going to help you in the future. So I think I'm that kind of mum. Like, it's more like, okay, let me make sure you're doing what you need to do for yourself. I'm not going to be handholding everything, even at two. Clean up, child.
The comparison I often hear is people's businesses are often like their other children.
Yes, yes.
It feels like you created BYP so organically, mm-hmm. and it doesn't feel like there's much pressure. And so do you feel like it's another child, or does it, what's the relationship like there?
I think, you know, different seasons, right? I think when I started BYP Now, I was 24 years old. I started in my bedroom. I was like, oh, this is an idea I have to change the narrative because the world is so terrible. And the narrative of the Black community is so negative. Like, it's knife crime, it's gun crime, it's low attainment, it's we're not getting into top jobs, we're not CEOs, we're not, it was just always negative is what I saw. And I saw that we weren't in spaces and we didn't feel like we belonged. And then Black Lives Matter was happening as well. Again, that kind of continuous push of like, our lives don't even matter. And then obviously I'm Nigerian background. So looking at Nigeria or Africa, what's going on there, the corruption, you know, people not doing so well, just so much negativity when it comes to the Black community. And I think for me, BYP Now, it came as like, I'm trying to solve a problem. But I don't believe I'm the only one who could solve this. I believe loads of people can solve this. This is just my idea. I remember thinking that this is just an idea. Let's just see what happens. Maybe someone else could have a better idea. And that's good. Have a better idea. So that's why it was organic. Because no one was like, Kike, you must start BYP. It just came to me and I was like, oh, let me just get started. Again, information. I didn't know about fundraising. I didn't know about anything to do with startup world. I just thought, let me just start right now in my room and get... I think I knew a bit about business because I had done business studies in GCSE. Me and my friend kind of started a business together, Clothing Line. And then I did a master's in management as well. So I had like business knowledge, I always say. So I could just get started as well because I have understanding that you need to get an accountant, get a lawyer, get your social media, register the company. So I knew those basics. But it just was very natural. I just kind of got on with it. And so it's very different. I think people call it your baby. And when it was the only thing I was focused on, yes. But it's been like nearly 8 years now. So it's a child, a grown child.
Teenager.
No, yeah, a teenager. Nearly a teenager. Tweenager.
Yeah. Trying to change the Black narrative from being quite negative. Mm. What's your version of the positive narrative that you would love to see?
Oh, God, I could. It's like if we could really paint the picture. Even if I can just start with Africa as a continent, right? Like, I think I always say that unless Africa is what it's supposed to be, us as the Black community will never be what we're supposed to be. And what I mean by that is that no matter how well you're doing, someone could look at that ad that says, feed this Black kid that's skinny because they're going through poverty and wherever it is in Africa, and they'll look and they'll associate that with you. Sadly, that's the reality. Or you're doing so well and they read the paper and it's about knife crime and they'll still associate that. So for us, it's like, one, us as a diaspora as well, those on the ground, how can we be part of that solution? How can we be part of each one, you know, teach one, each one, lift one? My mum had this great idea where she's like, charity begins at home, where whenever you travel back to Nigeria or Africa for home, you volunteer, you do something when you're there. Like if you're a doctor, go to go and help out the local hospital. And even us at BYP Network, we hire Nigerian talent. So we have like 7 people from Nigeria on our team that we're responsible for. And that's just an example. That's just us doing that. But like if everyone did their part with the continent, even as we are right now, I think that would make a huge difference. And that would be the starting of that. But then again, us here in the Western world, it is those narratives, right? We're trying to advance our careers in the world of work. And it is about us. Yeah, we're there. We're taking up space. We're in the C-suite. And we're representative of how many of us are in London or New York, wherever that looks like. There isn't that feeling of like microaggressions or you don't belong here and intimidation. Just all the things that Black professionals go through. Like you shouldn't feel like, oh, I applied for this job, but my name made me change it because they might throw it in a bin because it's African sounding name. So things like that gone. When they think of a Black professional, a Black student, a Black person, it's positive thoughts, which it should be. It shouldn't be thinking, oh, I remember someone gave a story about like someone said, oh, you're going to pull out your knife or something like that. Like just something so ridiculous. Like those kind of stereotypes that people will now say because they're comfortable saying it. It's just turning that upside on its head. Like through BYP, through not just BYP, through Black professionals, through just all the different initiatives, we've turned that around to show you like, look, like this is, and it's not for anyone else's gaze, it's for us as individuals and as a community. But again, stats come out again, oh, we're the lowest homeowners. you know, generational wealth isn't a thing in the community. This, it's always just this continuous cycle of like negativity. And it's like, how do we combat all of that? And I think that's the kind of utopia state of like, we're just thriving, we're multifaceted, we're, you know, yes, I'm a hip hop artist, but yes, I am the director of this FTSE 100 company, like whatever it needs to be, but it shouldn't be a surprise. I think that's the key. And I think through BYP Network, that's why a lot of the work that we do is like, one, networking, you know, you can't be what you can't see. How do I meet other Black professionals in my industry, in other industries? What are they up to? Oh, wow, I didn't know you could. There's jobs in that field and you can do it by doing this course. And now I can do that. And I think it always goes back to my grounding of access to information. I think at the heart of BYP Network, that's what it is. We're just trying to give you the information you need to succeed. So, you know, come and learn from one of our partner companies about, you know, how to get into tech. And then through that, you network with someone there and you might get a job. Because yes, you've applied and you're good enough, but now that you know them, they also kind of like, oh, has Tom applied? And that makes a difference, right? So it is that state of just us being a lot more connected, us kind of understanding that we can achieve anything and there isn't the barriers in place. And these negative statistics are turned around.
I love this circle back to access to information. But then it seems like what's really unique about you is even when you have the information, you choose what to focus on and what not to focus on. And so the stats about Black female founders raising funding are horrifying. It's like 0.1% or something, right? Yeah. But that's not the narrative that you focus on. It's not the narrative that defines you.
Yeah.
And so it feels like it's the combination of these two things, like having the information and then choosing what's empowering.
Yeah, exactly that, right? So whether, so again, going back to the negative stats I highlighted, BYP was like this alternative. Okay, these are the stats they put out there. And this is the no, we're not going to focus on that. Let's focus on the other side, the truth as well. Like, yes, there is that. But hey, there is John, who literally is a Black professional who has killed it in his career. Nobody is talking about him. He's not a celebrity. We need to amplify John. You guys need the information about John. And I think that's the difference. So yes, even with female founders, it's so bad in terms of funding. It's terrible. It's disgusting. But I think for me, I was like, block that out. Let me do a crowdfund and let's raise money that way. But it still doesn't take away from the realities of that. That's one thing I'd say. And I love the fact there are people fighting in that space. And I do believe people have to choose their battles of what they fight. Yeah, I think that's so important.
Wow. I mean, hats off. Like, that's, that's so wicked. And I can see it. Like, just I chatted to Sunny earlier and your social media manager, and the word that she used was inspiring. She's running a couple of businesses as well. Yeah. And she was like, oh no, but Kike's, she's doing like all of these different things. She has so much going on. And whenever I feel like, oh, I just can't be bothered, I always think about Kike.
Oh, that's so sweet.
And so it really feels like you are having that ripple effect. And it's making such a massive impact. Yes. BYP has obviously created something really special for a community that needs it, and you've grown massively. You've got 150,000 members, which is nuts by any community standards. Agreed, definitely not enough. So what do you think has allowed you to build it to this stage, and what will help you build it to the next stage?
Yeah, great question. I think we've definitely we've been at 150,000 now for a couple of years, or around that about. I think we've been more nurturing the community. And I think for us, the next level is, we also got our tech platform. We've got a platform called Javelin, an AI platform that allows our members to log in, upload their CV and get matched to the different jobs. So they don't have to search for it. And they also get matched to the events and match the content. But it's to continue to build that out more, like bigger and better. And then that's what we really want to scale. And that's what we want to scale in terms of community members. A lot of community is like all over the place. Like, it's our newsletters, it's our tech platforms, because we have a few, it's our social media, it's our networks. Whereas I think for us, we want to kind of get it all on our one platform, Javelin and beyond, and then start cultivating that. And the reason why it's been a long journey with tech, as in when I started BYP Network, the idea was tech platform and we had one, but it was a white labeled platform. And when I first raised, they're like, no, you have to build your own, can't have white label. Like, that was the advice basically given. And so we went on a journey of building our own, and then just tech in general is just always cost more than it should, and then developers not developing well, and then it's buggy. So I've gone through loads of start stops with building tech. And it's so crazy because some founders can build the tech, but they have no community. So, you know, it's done. But I think what's worked well for us is because I went first with the building of community. And again, my background was not community building. I don't know where that came from. Like, I was lonely, in that second year. So I don't know. I think because the idea was to solve a solution on, and it was like, okay, let's find each other. That was the premise of BYP Network. And then tech was like the scale of it, how to reach more people. So I think that's why it started as a community, because I'm like, who else has ideas? What are you up to? What can we do? Okay, let's meet. Let's be friends. And I always remember what made BYP stand out, because within like the first year, we were well known already in the community, is that we were very much like, leave your titles at the door. Like, it doesn't matter if you're a managing director or intern, just leave your titles at the door and let's all just connect naturally. And that was because of my own experiences in like banking. And I really felt like it was very like pretentious, basically. Like, it was so pretentious. Oh, sorry, I don't know how again. So I just remember like other interns or other like grads, like, you know, trying to get the MD, you know, and push. It was just like, oh, come on. And I never liked it. And so I remember with BYP Network, I was like, no, like everyone should freely be able to just network and meet people. And it shouldn't be this obvious grab for like whoever's at the top or whatever. And we need icebreaker games and stuff like that. And it was just fun. The first event was just this fun event. And that continued with BYP Network. And so, yeah, I think cultivating a community is like that first founding principles. And that's never left us. And I think others that are trying to build community, you need to know why you're trying to build community. And what is that founding principles? And what do you want from this community? And yeah, I've got like such a great engaged community. Like, whenever we put a call out, like right now, some community members are flyering for us in Liverpool Street for our careers festival. We've got about, I think, another 50 or so coming to our careers festival to volunteer. We have chapter leaders as well who like, yeah, I'd want to lead a chapter. And I think with BYP, it is because they understand the need for it. Like, okay, it's to connect with other Black professionals and advance your career. I'm the only Black person in my office. Like, you know, so straight away, it kind of resonates with people. And I think that's why, like, we've been able to just cultivate a community, because the need was clear.
The other part of community building, which I see community builders really struggling with, is making money from it. Mm. Loads of people want community, loads of people need community, loads of people want to build community, yeah. But people really struggle to get it off the ground because it's really hard to monetize.
Yeah.
Can you just break down how BYP makes money and where the most of it comes from?
Yeah, so when we first started that first year, like every event was charged. So it was ticketing for anything. So I always say I didn't lose money starting BYP Network. Like straight away, it was like we made money, use the money to do another event or whatever it is we were doing. So I think that's always the first bit. And I think all communities should charge something for participation. And what I mean by that is like, if you have an event, charge for the event. I don't necessarily just mean like just for them to exist in the community. I do like the tiered system of like, freemium is this. And if you want to pay this much a month, you get these benefits. I think that's good because you're giving people the option to select. So that's one way. And I'm just putting it out there. It's like, that's how we started. But what really changed our business model was more around COVID. So we stopped charging our community like during that COVID period because it was all online. It's like, I feel some people tried to, it just didn't make any sense, did it? So we kind of went free for the community, but we had continued charging corporate partners. So we had started charging corporate partners from, I think, 2018 is when we first started. And what they were paying for was like employer branding services, access to the community, the ability to kind of showcase their jobs, showcase their internal talent, meet potential talent. And that was through our conferences, our careers festivals, content pieces as well. So like day in the lives of articles. And then also the events they host in their offices and stuff like that. So that's kind of how we've been charging companies. And we've just, again, I never know. I'm like, we've never even had a marketing team. Like till now, we do not have a marketing team. Like we've never had a marketing team. But I think the brand just spread. Like that's just the best way I can describe it. So like even like our job board, for example, Javelin, whatever, we've had over 2,000 companies use it. So and these are like big names that have come and just I'm like, how did you even find us? We don't even have SEO. I don't even know what SEO at this point. Sorry, investors. So that was always kind of quite baffling to me. But we do work with a lot of large companies. Like, don't like name dropping per se, but
I'll name drop for you. Meta, Ogilvy.
Yeah, like exactly. Like, you know, Ogilvy, Morgan Stanley, Fitch. Like, I feel bad. Why I don't like name dropping is because then they're like, why don't you name drop us? I guess for our careers festival, for example, we've got such great logos like British Airways, Jaguar Land Rover, Tesco, BCG. So these are kind of companies that will be at our careers festival. But these are the kind of companies we work with anyway. And so BYP Network just always resonated. And we just attracted large clients from the get-go. I don't know. So I hope it's given. I think what I'm trying to say for community builders is like, yeah, build your community and let your community speak for you. Because also I think what it is like some of our communities might work at these companies and tell their company, oh, you should work at BYP Network. Or like the postings that we do a lot of social postings. All our events as well, we used to always have hashtags, and back in the day we used to have like really cool props. And so I think all of that helps spread the word about BYP Network. And so I always said it's like they got it. Like, members got it, companies got it. Like, they just seemed to get what we do and why we were needed. Even before the 2020 George Floyd murder, like, they had just got it. And I think, obviously, after that, obviously, things skyrocketed because they all just came running. But then, yeah, it's always about knowing, like, the money you want to take and the money you don't want to take, because some things are virtual signaling as well.
These are really, really valuable lessons. Sadly, I could go on for hours, but that's all we've got time for. Way I love to end this is, because you've been so generous with your time, assuming this is listened to by a bunch of entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs, what is something that an audience, that sort of audience, could support you with?
Leads, just bring in more leads. Tell your friends to tell your friends. And if you're entrepreneurs and founders, come work with us. It starts well, actually, at that level. And I think that because we work with such large brands, founders and startup companies don't work with us as much because they think, oh, we're not big enough. And we've had a company say that, oh, you know, we're not as big as, and so it kind of does scare people. But obviously, no, it's not just about the large brands. It's about any company that wants to be more representative internally.
And change the black narrative.
And change the black narrative.
Incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.